We're talking about poison and the work of the Wisconsin Poison Center on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In response to the pandemic threats, the American Association of Poison Control Centers is working with centers across the country to track common exposures and provide awareness for prevention. And to date, they've issued bulletins on bleach, on disinfectants, hand sanitizers, and ivermectin, providing exposure data from the National Poison Data System. What questions do you have for a toxicologist? Have you or a loved one accidentally ingested a chemical? What happened? 800-642-1234. Ryan Feldman is a toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center located in Milwaukee and an emergency medicine clinical pharmacist at Frederick Hospital. He hosts the podcast called The Poison Lab. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, good morning. Let's start with a working definition. How do you define poison? What does it mean that something is poisonous?
Right. That's a great question. It's actually, as you said in the intro, something we cover in the very first episode of the Poison Lab podcast. But truthfully, pretty much everything can be a poison. There was a Swiss physician in the 1600s named Paracelsus, and he had this saying that you might have heard, which is, all things are poison, and poison is in everything. The dosage alone is what makes things not a poison. And a lot of times that gets shortened to, the dose makes the poison. And that's really true. All substances have the potential to cause toxicity. It's just a matter if you get enough of the substance. Take, for example, cyanide. Many people know that that's a pretty deadly poison, but your body actually makes a small amount of cyanide every day, just small enough that your body can easily handle it and detoxify it without any problem. If you were to get a higher dose of cyanide than, say, your body makes by getting some in a tablet, well, then that cyanide might be able to start interfering with other important biologic systems and become a poison as it's causing toxicity. So really anything can be a poison if the dose of the substance overwhelms the biologic system. Water, oxygen, salt, all things that we have kind of every day can all become potential poisons. Medicines, plants, chemicals, really everything has the potential. So we are all surrounded by at least potentially poisonous substances every day.
All right. Well, a bit of language here as well. How does a poison then differ from a toxin?
Well, a poison and a toxin are essentially the same thing.
Okay.
Sometimes we'll say a venom is poison that comes from an animal, but really a poison and a toxin are any chemical. We use those words pretty much interchangeably. They're basically the same. Anything that can cause toxicity to the body.
I have in my mind that poison takes hold instantly, that it's an instant reaction. But is it possible for a person who's been poisoned not to look or act or feel sick?
Oh, well, yeah. Some symptoms of poisoning can be sort of insidious, meaning that they're nonspecific, or you might just, and this really depends on what the poison is. You might not know right away. Certain poisons can cause nonspecific symptoms that don't just shout, oh no, I'm poisoned. And then certain things that you're exposed to have delayed toxicity. We call those kind of toxic time bombs, where you might look okay originally and then later develop more severe toxicity. These are pretty rare and very unique circumstances. But yeah, it's possible.
I was just going to jump in here. Is there a particular age group that is prone to being poisoned? When you look at the data that you have and the federal government data, the Wisconsin data, there's a lot of data that you have. Who is most at risk?
Well, who is most at risk are the people most at risk for getting very high doses of a substance, right? So when many calls that come into a poison center, for instance, they're usually about 50% children and 50% adults. Kids tend to get into exploratory exposures where they see something that looks like a candy and maybe they put it in their mouth, but they're not taking a whole lot of it, or maybe they get a sip of a cleaner or something like that. So generally, they're not taking a whole bottle of medicines. And because of that, their doses are lower, and more often their outcomes are less severe. When we get into adults, this is where some intentionality comes into play with their ingestions. So we have people who are taking things for self-harm. We have people who are taking things to become intoxicated, or you get people ordering all sorts of things on the internet for purposes of, you know, either intoxication or, you know, weight loss supplements. And often, because of the intentionality here, they're taking much larger doses. And this certainly puts them at risk of an overdose on these substances and developing toxicity. And then certainly other people who are using unregulated substances. If you want to talk about someone who's in a high-risk category, people purchasing substances known to be biologically active that aren't regulated are certainly, they're at risk of very high doses of that substance. So let's take, for instance, people using illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. As you know, fentanyl is in a lot of illicit substances out there right now. It's a very potent drug, so you don't need a lot to overdose on it. And it's not well distributed throughout the supply chain of illicit drugs. So people can get really high doses in one batch and low doses in another. So this can lead to overdose if they're switching from one batch to another. Or people purchasing things from gas stations that aren't really regulated. If you've kept up in the news, we have the e-cigarette and vape associated lung injury outbreak just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. We have synthetic cannabinoids contaminated with super long acting rat poisons. Mm. So all these substances that don't really have any product regulation are very prone to both contamination and huge dose fluctuations that can lead to severe toxicity.
Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Ryan Feldman, who's a toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, and he hosts the podcast called The Poison Lab that explores the nature of his work. You can join in. Have you ever had to call the poison control hotline? What happened? What do you remember from that incident? Join in at 800-642-1234. There's that old catch-all remedy for suspected poisoning that was to induce vomiting. You want to drink water, induce vomiting. And I understand that you're going to tell us that that is no longer advised. What is with that age-old remedy?
Well, if you look, you know, in the past, there's a whole giving burnt toast used to be a treatment for poisoning. So there's really that has since evolved into some other more advanced antidotes. The vomiting we almost never recommend, truthfully, because number one, many poisons or many exposures are going to be okay. We don't always know, which is why I'd always recommend calling a poison center in the event of any exposure. That number is 1-800-222-1222, by the way. We don't necessarily want a parent trying to make their child vomit for something that's relatively innocuous. And then one of the biggest risks there is actually aspiration, or when the child chokes on the vomit, and that can cause a lot of severe medical outcomes. So we want to avoid that. And it's very rare that we would ever tell someone to induce vomiting. It almost never. There is also the possibility that vomiting can kind of push all the stomach contents, and sometimes you don't vomit everything out. So it's not even necessarily that effective. It can also push contents further into the gastric tract. So it's just not an effective antidote overall. You've probably heard of stomach pumping too. That is something that we almost never do anymore because of similar reasons. It's a very invasive procedure that you have to do, and usually the benefit just isn't there.
So what do you do? What are some of the remedies here when something goes really wrong with chemicals?
So remember, there's infinite poisons. Everything is a potential poison. Mm. But there's only about 30 or 40 antidotes. So for 99.9% of poisonings or toxicology, it's what we call good supportive care. So if you come into the emergency department, there's a couple of treatment principles that we follow. One is decontamination. We try to get the poison away from the patient. And that used to be, back in the day, syrup of ipecac to induce vomiting. We don't do that anymore. Now we might give something called activated charcoal. And we do that in a controlled setting and only in certain patients. And what that charcoal will do is go into the stomach and into the gastric system, and it will actually bind the toxin and keep it from absorbing into the body. So that is one way that we can prevent you from absorbing a poison. Now, there is activated charcoal over the counter, so I don't want anyone to get any wild ideas, because it's about a hundredth of the dose that we would normally give. So that would not be effective. But we will give activated charcoal. We will do supportive cares to maintain airway, so to make sure that person can breathe, keep their heart beating, and keep their blood pressure supported to perfuse their brain. And that's just basic general medicine practice. It really doesn't change much whether you're a poisoned patient or somebody who, you know, was in a car accident or is having a heart attack.
I just want to jump in here. Emergency medicine clinical pharmacist Ryan Feldman with us, our guide to the science, the medical management of harmful chemicals and toxins. Have you ever needed to call the poison control hotline? Join in. Do you remember the Mr. Yuck public service announcements from your childhood? Oh, I remember. How do you think we should warn kids about harmful household chemicals? How do you handle toxic chemicals? Where do you put them? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ryan Feldman on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the work of poison control centers and the things all around us that are extremely toxic to our health. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The New York Times in recent days has been reporting on young kids getting sick from cannabis edibles. They reported on how a growing number of children are inadvertently eating marijuana-laced foods at a time when states legalize cannabis and more marijuana edibles come to market that look like normal things that some kids like to eat. Chocolate, cookies, suckers, Skittle-like things. Do you think there should be stricter laws around highly toxic chemicals? What do you think of the childproof bottle caps for your meds in the bathroom? 800-642-1234. Emergency medicine clinical pharmacist Ryan Feldman of Frederick Hospital with us for the hour. Let's bring on a caller now. Elizabeth is joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hello. So I would say approximately 10 plus years ago, when we still used phone books, I was cleaning the bathroom, the walls and the tub, and it was a glass enclosed bathroom, so not a lot of ventilation. And I mixed chemicals. I remember using a bleach substance and something else on the tub and something else on the walls. And I breathed it in and couldn't breathe and went to the phone book, and I called a number there. The person answered, and I can't remember exactly what they walked me through in order to breathe again. But the one thing I do remember is the lady on the phone said to be careful, because now that that type of asphyxiation or something has happened to me once, that I would be more susceptible to things like that in the future if I don't know, some kind of chemicals were in the air. So I was wondering, is that accurate?
Elizabeth, thank you. Ryan Feldman.
So it sounds like you were mixing cleaners and potentially made, when you mix bleach with an acid, you can make chlorine gas, which is a World War I gas and could cause some serious problems. We call it a high solubility irritant because it dissolves right away into the eyes, into the mucous membranes of your lungs. So you usually detect it right away. Or you might have mixed it with something like ammonia and created chloramine gas, which has a very similar effect. It sounds like who was walking you through things was warning you of potential hypersensitivity reactions or the likelihood that you might be more reactive if you were re-exposed to a substance. That can happen in certain, you know, asthmatic conditions or people who are sensitized to an allergen. It's not necessarily 100% the case. It just sounds like something they were warning you about to provide full, complete information. But I'm glad that they were able to walk you through getting into fresh air and away from that toxic exposure.
Elizabeth, as the years have gone by, have you felt more susceptible to the chemicals that you clean with, or have you been more sensitive in this area?
I haven't felt like that's happened to me because I'd be more susceptible, but I definitely will never forget the experience. And every time I do get out a cleaner, I'm hugely aware of what I'm doing. So it definitely affected me that way.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing what you went through. Ryan, I would imagine you hear that a lot, that if it happens once, you're much more inclined to be very, very careful in the future.
Absolutely. Many of the people who call into a poison center or need the services of a toxicologist learned an unfortunate lesson about potential toxicity, and it's usually a good warning, assuming everything goes okay afterwards.
I want to follow up with you on consuming marijuana, and that can make children especially very sick. Have you seen calls about edibles involving younger children?
Yeah, actually, one of the podcast episodes called Setting the Record Straight on Delta 8 talks about the recent legalization of Delta 8 THC throughout the United States. And what this has basically done is, unfortunately, given access to the whole U.S. to these candies or things that look like candy that are chocked full of an intoxicating substance. And a lot of people aren't familiar with how to appropriately store and keep those away from kids. A kid is naturally going to explore and put things in their mouth, and especially things that look good and tasty. So really, throughout the nation, we're seeing increased exposures to this Delta 8 THC product, just like we've seen in states that have legalized edible marijuana products, increased exposures to Delta 9 THC, which is the standard marijuana edible that you kind of think of. And these products can cause sedation. They can cause abnormalities in heart rate and sometimes breathing, and warrant kids to need observation. So it's also pets too that are getting into these things. So people really need to be aware that these things are out there. Many of them are now legal due to the Farming Act, which made CBD and other hemp products legal. And you know, if you're bringing your kiddo over to grandpa and grandma's house, maybe just ask what they're taking for sleep, just to make sure that there's not anything laying around that they could get into, especially gummies or edibles.
Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, with us, host of the Poison Lab podcast, exploring his work around harmful chemicals and toxins. So, Ryan, I want to get in also into COVID-19, because we have seen the National Poison Control Center issuing these bulletins around wipes and disinfectants and ivermectin. What are you seeing there in relation to the pandemic?
Well, related to the pandemic, number one, right when things kind of started, we saw a massive increase in exposures to sanitizers and disinfectants. Suddenly, we had a lot of new household words like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. So anytime we have a new household word, it means that it's making its way through the public, and there's a higher chance that kids or adults are going to get exposed to it inappropriately. So we do see increased exposures with these things. Truthfully, the sanitizer problem, we were running into a lot of issues where we actually ran out of hand sanitizer throughout, you know, most of the U.S., and they were manufacturing it from other areas, and the manufacturing qualities weren't necessarily up to par. So we were finding a lot of methanol contaminated hand sanitizer. So normally, if a child drinks hand sanitizer, we're not too concerned. It's alcohol, and the kid may become intoxicated, but usually we can get them through that with minimal problems. Although it's case by case. But when there's methanol in the hand sanitizer, methanol can get metabolized to formic acid and cause blindness, as well as a lot of other problems. So we were really starting to get nervous about all the potential methanol contaminated hand sanitizers, and having to do a lot more testing and a lot more monitoring on these kids if they were exposed. There were some deaths nationwide of methanol-contaminated hand sanitizers, mainly in adults. So that was one of the issues, is we have kind of old substances becoming new in terms of what they're composed of. The FDA does have a great list of all of the manufacturers that have been identified to have methanol in them. If anyone's worried, you can check online. But then we had other things. bleach was a really common exposure because people were cleaning everything with mm-hmm. bleach and then sometimes ingesting things that they cleaned with bleach. So bleach is a disinfectant, meaning it should be used on hard, non-porous surfaces and not on humans. So you don't want to clean your food with it and mm-hmm. ingest it. It can be an irritant. I actually cover all of this in the first or second episode of the Poison Lab called Cooking or Cleaning with War Gas and Drinking Javel Water. Mm. Javel water was the name for bleach when it was invented in France in the, I believe, the 1800s.
Well, we need to pause right here with toxicologist and poison control pharmacist Ryan Feldman giving us a glimpse into poisons. Have you ever had to call the poison control hotline? What were the circumstances? Have you talked with your teen about social media challenges that involve harmful substances? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the work of the Wisconsin Poison Center on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent years, across the country, poison control centers have warned of online dares, like on TikTok, trying to get ahead of teens on dangerous social media challenges involving the medicine cabinet. What questions do you have about toxic chemicals stored under your kitchen sink or in your bathroom? Are you wondering about the toxicology of different chemicals and how they react inside the body? 800-642-1234. Ryan Feldman is an emergency medicine clinical pharmacist and toxicologist at Frederick Hospital with us for the hour. Ryan, we heard from Vern in Eau Claire, called in, couldn't stay with us, and said that ethyl alcohol or ethanol is the antidote for methanol poisoning and is wondering, is there any truth to this?
That is actually very true. It is a antidote for methanol poisoning, as well as some other things like ethylene glycol, which you'd find in antifreeze. Mm-hmm. It's not the best antidote. We have much better ones, but if we're in an absolute pinch and we can't find our other better antidotes, we might use those. So methanol and ethylene glycol are both metabolized in the body to toxic metabolites. We talked about before, methanol becomes formic acid, which can cause blindness, as well as some other very nasty effects. Ethylene glycol becomes something called oxalic acid, and that can cause kidney failure, as well as some nasty effects like acidosis, and both of them can be potentially fatal. So in order to prevent those compounds from being metabolized into their toxic metabolites, alcohol can be used, which is ethyl alcohol, the same alcohol you find in beer, wine. And basically, it occupies the enzyme that would metabolize methanol and ethylene glycol and keeps it from metabolizing those compounds by wrapping it up with alcohol. So it's a way that we can prevent the toxic metabolites, prevent toxicity, and actually clear those other toxins another way. It's pretty rare that we have to reach for that, but it is an interesting toxicology trivia.
Well, it's interesting to follow you on this chemistry journey because there is a lot going on in how chemicals react with one another. One thing in recent years that was in the news was detergent pods. As you're well aware, for poisoning children, pods were criticized because they resemble colorful candies. And we got a lot on the Tide pod scare. How did that public pressure and those poisoning incidents lead to change with this product?
Right. Well, Tide pods in general, laundry detergent pods, they're very colorful, very bright. Children are going to be naturally attracted to them. And unfortunately, they have a couple of chemicals in them that create some problems, especially if a child puts it in their mouth and it bursts and they aspirate or choke on it. Then we run into a lot of problems. So actually, at one of our toxicology conferences, the North American Congress of Clinical Toxicology, we were reporting on all of these negative outcomes associated with kids getting into Tide Pods. And basically, almost every toxicologist in the country with a Twitter was tweeting at Tide to try to address this.
Wow.
And it was some of that social pressure that actually caused them to repackage these into child-resistant packaging and put some labeling into their commercials about, well, at least my understanding is it was that pressure that caused them to do this. And quite thankfully, they did. I don't know about the outcome since they introduced the additional child-resistant packaging, but we were really seeing some unfortunate cases of prolonged respiratory or pulmonary issues after exposure to those products.
Can you walk us through what it is like to answer those calls at the Wisconsin Poison Center, a little bit about what that procedure is like and what happens in a call to the poison hotline?
Absolutely. So if you call a poison center, you're going to be talking to someone called a SPI, which is a specialist in poison information. These are just absolutely brilliant healthcare workers, usually nurses or pharmacists with extensive training in toxicology. They're basically like a 911 dispatcher mixed with a biochemist. They're going to be doing some great things during that call, like assessing the potential for toxicity based off the maximum that you could have been exposed to, triaging it and figuring out if this exposure really needs healthcare, you know, treatment, or is this someone who can hang out at home? So the vast majority of our cases that are handled at a poison center are actually managed at home, keeping people out of the hospital and preventing, you know, overwhelming of the healthcare system. So it's a really fantastic public health resource. Those SPIs will take information like your callback number, what the potential exposure was, past medical history. And if it is determined that you need to go to the hospital, they will coordinate with the hospital. They will give treatment recommendations to that hospital and actually follow your care throughout your entire stay. And it's been shown that if a poison center is involved in your care, you're going to spend less time in the hospital and less money will be spent on you for certain demographics, especially kids. So those SPIs will assess and triage things based off of guidelines and make recommendations. So I was a SPI for many years. When I credentialed as a toxicologist, now I work with the group of toxicologists who does medical backup for the poison center. So we help write those guidelines that they use, and we're available 24 hours a day. We're not necessarily public facing that you're going to talk to us on the phone, but we're available 24 hours a day via pager to help the SPIs with medical decision making.
I would imagine SPIs have to know so much. Any type of call could come in. They have to be ready for anything.
Absolutely. I mean, they work a free public access line that people can call when they think they've been poisoned. So they also have a lot of pretty crazy stories as well. So if you ever get a chance to pick the brain of a SPI, I really recommend you do. I wouldn't call the poison center just to pick their brain, but they're really, really intelligent and just a fantastic resource to have. We have toxicologists there to back them up at all times and do direct consults with hospitals and things like that.
I would imagine, too, that they are looking things up in the background. They're having consultations with you in the background, trying to make sure they fully understand all the complications that might arise.
Absolutely. So, yeah, they are well-resourced, and they always have access to additional medical management resources. There is actually a great website if you want to get an idea of the kind of poisons that are kind of exposures that get called in. The Georgia Poison Control Center posted a day's worth of calls on their website. I think it's called, you know, Saving Hundreds of Stories and Hundreds of Lives. But if you go to Georgia Poison Control Center's website, you can look at a call log of all the different things that get called into them throughout the day. And the range is really extensive. I know when you talk about poisoning, a lot of people probably think, you know, kings being poisoned with a chalice or somebody getting shot with a dart gun. But a lot more of it is really, we get a lot of home exposures. About 2/3 of the calls are from people at home where a child maybe got into somebody's medicine or some sort of a, you know, maybe they got into some gasoline and took a sip. Or the other 1/3 are actually from healthcare facilities throughout the state of Wisconsin calling us for treatment recommendations. So it's really variable.
Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, hosts the podcast The Poison Lab. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. The federal structure and the oversight with the Poison Control Center system and this nationwide network, you mentioned Georgia Poison Center. what would happen if this structure didn't exist, if this resource didn't exist?
That is a fantastic question. I do think there would be some crumbling in some areas. I mean, to be honest, the fact that this resource is a free resource to the public and has such incredibly well-trained experts available, I think is already amazing. The resource works to keep people at home who don't need to go to a hospital and to reduce the burden of, or to reduce length of stay, as well as provide accurate treatment recommendations to people who are in the hospital. So the overall care of a poisoned patient would definitely decline, and the overall increase in healthcare burden would increase due to far more people showing up to emergency departments with poisons that don't necessarily need to be seen in healthcare. It really is an important infrastructure, not only for treating patients, but also for toxico surveillance.
Hmm.
So the e-cigarette and vape-associated lung injury outbreak was identified here in Wisconsin, and the Poison Center was integral in reporting things to the Department of Health and tracking cases. The synthetic cannabinoid rat poison outbreak, poison centers were integral in tracking patients, getting them coordinated with care, getting them coordinated with antidote recommendations for discharge. So they're a huge public health asset, not just for acute poisonings, but for monitoring and surveillance of ongoing outbreaks.
And you can see in the charts that come out through the bulletins, just the frequency of the calls, and the charts really kind of indicate what is happening over the course of a year, or what is happening in certain areas. You get a lot more insight.
Absolutely. Real-time tracking goes on. We monitor for anomalies. You know, we can detect carbon monoxide outbreaks in certain areas where, you know, if suddenly we see a huge rush of carbon monoxide calls to five different hospitals in an area. Well, those hospitals might not be talking with each other, but they're all talking to one poison center about the carbon monoxide. And that can pick up on a potential signal that maybe we need to investigate where there's a gas leak or something like that. So,
I want to pick up on that, because last year ProPublica released a report detailing how portable power generators poison thousands of people a year with carbon monoxide. How can generators poison people?
Oh, yeah. So unfortunately, carbon monoxide is a problem in many areas where it gets cold. Anytime there's incomplete combustion, so your portable generator isn't fully burning all the gas, and this is just sometimes with older units, you're going to generate a little bit of carbon monoxide. It's the same thing that occurs in older cars. So carbon monoxide is a blood poison, and as well, it basically prevents your body from being able to use oxygen appropriately. And it kind of, at low levels, it's really non-specific symptoms. You might feel headache or fatigue, but at high levels, it absolutely can cause fatality. And in Texas, during their freeze, many deaths occurred due to carbon monoxide from people turning on generators that weren't working. So the biggest thing people can do is buy a carbon monoxide detector. You absolutely should have one, because it is a real risk in almost any enclosed space where you have a generator that's not combusting completely.
Wisconsin Poison Center toxicologist Ryan Feldman is with us on poison control, toxic exposures, what you need to know. What is your instinct to do in a poisoning emergency? What questions do you have about who is at risk for poisoning? Are there poisoning alerts in the news you've encountered during the pandemic you want to bring up and ask about? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ryan Feldman here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the dangers of poison on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A poison is anything that can harm someone if it's used in the wrong way, used by the wrong person, used in the wrong amount. That is from the Health Resources and Services Administration. Still time to talk about poison control, what you encounter on labels, 800-642-1234. Toxicologist Ryan Feldman with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on David now in Appleton. Hi, David.
Hi. I actually work for a suicide prevention hotline, and sometimes we have people who call us and take a massive overdose and then say, you know, I really regret doing this. I don't want to die. And they ask if they should throw it up, make themselves throw it up. Should we advise them to do that or not?
David, thank you for that question. Yes.
That's a great question. And thanks for the work that you do, David. We do not advise vomiting for any poisoning ingestion. What you should do and what everyone should do if there is an exposure is call the poison center, where you're going to get free medical advice of exactly how to treat that exposure. So, and when I say any, I never like to use absolutes, but we're almost never going to recommend vomiting for the reasons we talked about before. So they should call 1-800-222-1222, where a trained medical professional for free is going to assess the toxicity of the situation and make treatment recommendations, organize care, ensure that that patient gets the best possible treatment and is able to hopefully survive their unfortunate situation.
David, does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Bernard in Racine. Hi, Bernard.
Yeah, I'm here. My question would be, in construction, there's MSDS sheets and SDS, material safety data sheets, and they list the what is in a can of WD, and if somebody were to be exposed to it and they're going to the hospital. I've never seen this resource be used in the construction. I mean, we have to have it. We do it. But is this helpful, or is this just something that once somebody's in an ambulance, you pretty much have handle on it? Because I've never seen this resource really used.
And when you say WD, like WD-40? Following. Yeah, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
And so you have these sheets that are a list of ingredients in these products.
Right. And it's required to be on the job. So if somebody's exposed to something, you can inform them and then you have that list. But, you know, in 30 years of construction, I've never seen this resource be used. I'm just curious.
Thank you. Ryan.
Yeah, great question. And actually, it is a valuable resource. So sometimes half the battle of a poisoning or an exposure is figuring out exactly what you were exposed to. Many patients who come into the emergency department, we don't always know, or the story kind of gets jumbled on its way through the paramedics. They get only half the story, and then we get a quarter of the story in the emergency department. So when calling the poison center, having the MSDS or the SDS with the exact ingredients is incredibly helpful, as well as having it on you when you go into the hospital so they know what to deal with and they can call the poison center and say what you're exposed to. I've had industrial, you know, chemical exposures occur in the emergency department, and it's so helpful when they have that SDS or MSDS. So I know exactly what to go after or what potential toxins we're dealing with.
Bernard, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate it. You know, sometimes people can overdose on drugs like aspirin or Tylenol, things in the medicine cabinet. What happens when you do take too much of an over-the-counter pain medication?
So aspirin and acetaminophen are actually very, very toxic in overdose. At regular doses, remember, the dose makes the poison. Acetaminophen is incredibly, which is Tylenol, incredibly well tolerated as long as you're staying at the recommended dose. But in overdose, it's actually, and I would have to double check, I believe it's the third leading cause of liver transplant after alcohol and actually it might be the second after. It's the second leading cause of drug-related liver transplant, I believe.
Hmm.
So it's a hepatotoxin, as we call it. And it damages the liver, and it can create basically a pretty prolonged toxic course as the liver fails and the rest of the organs try to compensate for it. So acetaminophen in overdose can be very dangerous. We have an amazing, almost 100% effective antidote to prevent toxicity from it, but people need to call the poison center or go into care to figure out if they need it. So acetaminophen really can be a problem, but it's almost a miracle at how well we can prevent the toxicity from it if we get to them in time. So any exposure to Tylenol or acetaminophen, I would absolutely recommend calling the poison center to figure out if it's one that might need an antidote.
Have you made Texas City strides in being able to reverse deadly situations? I mean, I'm thinking of naloxone as one example.
Absolutely. I will just say for a moment, salicylate or aspirin also can be very, very deadly. So I do want people to call a poison center if you have a kid exposed to something like that as well. We have made big, some strides. There's new antidotes coming out somewhat every year, or we're finding old uses new uses for old antidotes in ways that we weren't aware of before. So for instance, one of those antidotes that we use for methanol and ethylene glycol is called fomepizole, and it blocks the metabolism of those agents. And we're finding that if we use that and maybe in some acetaminophen poisonings, even if they present really late beyond the time we could normally use an antidote, it might have a benefit. So we're always doing research. We're always searching for new potential antidotes or new ways to repurpose old antidotes. And the care of a poisoned patient with good supportive cares and these antidotes has really improved over the last 50 years. Mortality rates are generally low compared to other disease states.
That's very optimistic, because these situations can be so stressful for the person involved, for the people around them. If you are a loved one, what can you do in these moments when you look at your child who has just ingested something that is very dangerous?
You can call the poison center, who will tell you exactly if that is dangerous or not and exactly mm-hmm. what to do about it. I mean, trained experts are there waiting to take that call. So, I will say poisoning is a really broad word, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, infinite poison. So there are some things out there that we really just, you unfortunately can't do a lot about, but many of these things, we can give things to bind it in your stomach. We can support your airway breathing and circulation. We can use special machines to clean the poison out of your blood. We do have some advanced therapies, and that's really great. But I can't say as a blanket statement we can do, everything is a curable poisoning. So it all depends on what the exposure is. And for that, we need a trained medical expert to figure out how toxic it could be. And you can find those at a poison center.
We only have a few seconds left. I'm just wondering, Ryan, what draws you to this work and the understanding of the biochemistry going on and the work of helping people?
Well, it's really a powerful thing to use knowledge of a biochemical pathway to prevent someone from going blind or losing their kidneys, or use a drug to reverse the effects of another drug and bring somebody back from an overdose. It's almost an immediate gratification, if that is something. And unfortunately, a toxic or poison exposure is generally an unfortunate situation. So to be able to be there and use knowledge that I was trained to use in order to improve the outcomes of that patient in one of their worst times is really a privilege and something I don't take lightly. So it's a very great opportunity.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Kate. It was wonderful.
Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center. For disclosure, Frederick Hospital is a business sponsor of WPR. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.